Amen. Well, it's great to see you today. Glad you joined us for worship. Let's turn in our Bibles to Acts chapter 9, the ninth chapter of Acts. We are going through the New Testament this year and picking out key Bible stories along the way. And we've come to one of the most fascinating and radical stories of all. It's where a guy named Saul, who was out there persecuting and killing Christians. He's actually the one who was responsible for Stephen, the first martyr of the church, being stoned in Acts chapter 7. He is the most radical person against Christianity, and here, in a matter of days, becomes the greatest advocate for Christianity, becomes the one who ultimately wrote most of the New Testament. It's an amazing story, and it's fun to look at it. Now, here he is called Saul. We usually know him as Paul, and a lot of times people get the wrong idea that somehow God changed his name from Saul to Paul. That really wasn't the case from everything that the Bible says. Saul, he was Jewish, and so his Hebrew name was Saul. Of course, that was an important name to Jews because their first king, who was from the same tribe as Saul, the tribe of Benjamin, the first king of Israel, was named Saul, so he probably was named after Saul. Now, where does the name Paul come in? Saul's father was a Roman citizen, so he would have had a Latin name, and so he had the name Paul. The name Saul in Hebrew means you asked for it, or you prayed for it. I prefer to think of it as you asked for it, because remember King Saul, the people were like, we want a king that looks good, that's tall, that's impressive. And God goes, okay, you asked for it, here's Saul. The name Paul means shorty, and so he's probably a little guy, and that became his nickname. And ultimately, after Acts chapter 13, he's always referred to by Luke as Paul, so he probably went more by that name. But there was nothing about it that was like, you know, God said, you were the one that was asked for. Now you're just the little guy. That preaches well, but it really isn't. There isn't anything to it. But here he's referred to as Saul. And by the way, his name didn't change when he got converted, because if you look at Acts chapter 13, you see that there, as he's going on a missionary trip, he's still called Saul. Acts chapter 9. The story of Saul's conversion, is one that you find it here in Acts chapter 9. You find it as he shares it in Acts 22, as he shares it again in Acts chapter 26, and as he shares it again in Galatians chapter 1. So it's obviously a big deal to him, big deal to the church. This kind of turnaround is crazy. It's almost unprecedented, unheard of. So let's look at the story very quickly. Acts chapter 9, beginning with verse 1. Then Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked letters from him to the synagogue of Damascus, which was the capital of Syria, still is today, so that if he found any who were of the way, it's what they called the church at the time, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. So back in chapter 7, he was the one who was responsible for killing Stephen. He hasn't mellowed one bit. He's still breathing violence. He's still adamantly opposed to Christianity. Now, Christianity at this point was almost exclusively a Jewish phenomenon. In the next chapter, in Acts chapter 10, you have a Roman centurion who ends up, Cornelius, who ends up, because of Peter's testimony, some Gentiles become Christians. Later on, of course, Paul spent most of his life ministering to Gentiles. At this point, Christianity is just a sect of Judaism. And so Saul, as a Hebrew of the Hebrews, as somebody who was like wanting to defend the faith, he realized, man, this thing is growing and it could threaten the entire Jewish religion. And so he is pumped to snuff it out, to stomp it out, to stop it. And so he's like breathing this. He's so upset. And he got permission from the Jewish leaders. Can I go up to the synagogues in Syria, and can I get the people that are Christians who are trying to infiltrate our faith and pull them down and bring them before a Jewish tribunal. If they resist arrest, maybe kill them like we did Stephen. So here's a guy who is as against Christianity as anyone could possibly be. He is into it. And verse 3, the story, the plot thickens. As he journeyed, no doubt with a team of people who were going to help him do his bidding, as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly a light shone around him from heaven. Then he fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Over in chapter 26, he says he spoke to me in Hebrew. So he hears this Hebrew voice coming out of heaven saying, "Why are you persecuting me?" And he said, Paul said, "Who are you, Lord?" Then the Lord said, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. It is hard for you to kick against the goads, isn't it?" And now, by the way, if you have a modern translation, some of them don't have that line, "It's hard to kick against the goads." But that line is in all the manuscripts in chapter 22, 26, Galatians chapter 1. So we know that Jesus said it. Whether Luke had it in there or somehow it got left out or somebody had added it, we don't know. But he's knocked down. He can't see. All he can see is this bright light. He hears this voice calling him by name in Hebrew and saying, "You're persecuting me." And he's like, "Well, who are you?" "I am Jesus. Now, why are you resisting my goading?" The goad was a long stick that farmers and others who were using oxen would use, because oxen are big and you can't really push them or pull them. And so a goad was a stick with an iron prong on the end of it, sometimes with a hook. And so you just tap the oxen to get him going. And then if he starts veering off because you want to row straight rows, keep them in line, you poke them on one side or the other. So Jesus is saying, "Why is it that you are kicking against my prodding?" You know, if an oxen was particularly stubborn, they would just, instead of moving, they would kick back. Jesus says, basically, "Why are you doing that to me?" And so as this happens in verse 6, he trembled. Trembling and astonished, says, "Lord, what do you want me to do?" And the Lord said to him, "Arise and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do." And the men who journeyed with him stood speechless. They heard a voice, or they heard the sound, but they didn't see anyone. So Saul arose from the ground, and when his eyes were opened, he saw no one. But they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. He was blind. And he was 3 days without sight and neither ate nor drank. So he went to Syria being led by his associates, and he couldn't see a thing. And he came to the house, ironically, of a guy named Judas, and he just rented a room there, and he was waiting, and he wouldn't eat. And into the story now comes a Jewish Christian named Ananias, and he has a vision. And it says in verse 10, there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias, one of the ones that Paul no doubt was coming after. And to him, the Lord had said in a vision, "Ananias." And he said, "Here I am, Lord." The Lord said to him, "Arise and go to the street called Straight and inquire at the house of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus, for behold, he is praying." So we know that Saul was just there praying and blind. And in a vision, he has seen a man named Ananias coming in and putting his hand on him so that he might receive his sight. Then Ananias answered, "Lord, I have heard from many about this man, Saul of Tarsus, how much harm he has done to your saints in Jerusalem. And here he has authority from the chief priests to bind all who call on your name." But the Lord said to Ananias, "Go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake." And Ananias went his way and entered the house. And laying his hands on him, he said, "Brother Saul, The Lord Jesus, who appeared to you on the road as you came, has sent me that you may receive your sight and be filled with the Holy Spirit. Immediately, verse 18, there fell from his eyes something like scales, and he received his sight at once, and he arose and was baptized. So when he had received food, he was strengthened. And then Saul spent some days with the disciples at Damascus. You go on and read the rest of the chapter. Right away, Saul is preaching in Damascus. Now, we know from Galatians chapter 1, at some point, he went from Damascus east into the deserts of Saudi Arabia, spent an undetermined period of time with being discipled by the Lord, and then came back to Damascus. And then as we read here, after ministering up there, he ultimately, 3 years after his conversion, went down to Jerusalem. The disciples were scared to death of him. They didn't trust him. And so a guy named Barnabas, who would become his traveling partner, went to bat for him. And finally they realized, I guess this guy's for real. Then he spent most of the rest of his life going out and planting churches and evangelizing among the Gentiles. Now, we look at the story and just go, what a change. Who in the world could envision that the guy who's breathing death toward these believers in Jesus would make a 180-degree turn and become somebody who is the greatest advocate, who wrote, I believe, 14 books of the New Testament? Wow, who could have seen that? What an amazing miracle. But I would suggest to you that it wasn't quite a 180-degree change. You see, as you look at his life, that a lot of it was simply God working with who Saul was and using him in a more specialized and a more constructive way. Yeah, it looks like a 180-degree change, but the truth is God picked a particular person with his passions and his gifts in order to then be used to do something for him. And when we see this story, you can't help but be inspired and go, somebody who's that bad became that good, had that great of an influence, and how it touches us. And to go, this guy who looked like the enemy of Christ changed the world because God was working through him. When I look at the story, I just ask myself, how does someone become one who changes the world? Someone who makes a difference in the lives of others that goes way beyond who they are and where they are. Because Paul stands out as somebody in the early church, no one, probably no one other than Jesus throughout the history of church history has ever had the kind of impact that Saul had. And this is where things turned. And so there's a lot we can learn from it. Really quickly, the first thing that I notice about Saul that I think is important to him, for him to do what he did, is that he was a greatly passionate man. He had a passion. If he was going to be against Christians, he was going to be more against Christians than anyone. He's breathing violence. He seems to be unmoved as he even watches Stephen killed at his direction. It's like it doesn't move him. It makes him like, I'm more into this than ever. If we're going to be against the church, I'm going to be against them 100%. Now, here's what you might think about. Quite often, in fact, almost always, the people that really make a difference in the world, people that really make a difference for God, start out as passionate people. Now, we love the turnaround story because so often there are people who God has greatly used, and then you find out, wow, they were really bad people. And then all of a sudden they turned into really good people. So we look at that and go, that's amazing. But maybe it's not quite as amazing sometimes as we think. Because in order to change the world, you have to have passion. And even having passion for the wrong things, at least you care. It's probably why Jesus said in the church at Laodicea, I would rather have you be hot or cold. Because if you're lukewarm, I'll spit you out of my mouth. People who are without passion will never make a difference anywhere. Now, the problem is, in our culture, in our society, we try to do everything we can to take the passion out of people. The reason if you're managing people, it's easier to manage dispassionate people than it is to marry passionate people, to manage passionate people. And goes for marriage as well. That must have been Freudian. What our culture does, what our educational system does, is it tries to program passion out of people so that then they will be good citizens. So the ones who are like set up as examples are people who don't really care about much of anything, but they just don't do anything wrong, like Hitler's youth. The book 1984 by George Orwell, which in light of our culture today, it might be good to go back and read that. This is something that Orwell predicted would happen, that you would have Big Brother, the government, who tells you what to feel and tells you what to think and makes everyone alike. It was this beautiful picture of political correctness where you knock the edge off of everyone. That's kind of what we try to do. It's what our educational system does. It's why, you know, our educational system is basically geared toward utilitarianism. It used to be that everyone's education included music and the arts and you know, just the beauty of old cultural literature and architecture and everything else. But somehow we've decided that the only thing that we need to do in school is to help people get a job. And so you have a generation of people, you look at almost any university today, and you have probably the biggest major at most universities, business major, because it's going to get you a job you hate, a job that doesn't have passion, but it'll pay the bills, so a couple weeks a year you can go have a passionate vacation, wear yourself out, and come back to being a dispassionate person. So what do we cut out? We don't have music. We don't have art. If you want any of that, you're going to have to pay extra for it. You know, we don't encourage people. We don't even have creative writing because it's too hard to grade. We have people grading students based on guessing A, B, C, or D, and we call it education. But the cost of that is that if somebody is passionate, we brand them as attention deficit. We give them medication so that we can take the edge off their passion. And I'm sorry, and I'm not, you know, I'm just saying. Why do we do that? Because it works. Because it's the easiest way to have a big class full of people that don't make any trouble for you. And ultimately, our culture, now, there are rare exceptions. But, you know, you look at it, okay, if you're an English major, if you major in humanities, or in art, something creative, you'll be able to get a job at Starbucks. But, you know, everyone can do art now. You have a computer and a laser printer, and you can just make these fancy things. That you don't have to create anything. You don't have to draw anything. You don't even have to think. You don't have to remember or use your imagination because there's software for that. There are people who do that. And then these radical people with great imaginations, they are making a difference. But for most of us, it's like the passion was kicked out of us a long time ago because that's how you manage people. You take their passion away. And again, that was the message of 1984. And that's the world in which we live now. And that's why you have somebody like Saul who has this crazy, radical potential. Now, at least he was passionate. And I think for a lot of us, one of the questions that I have in the small group discussion questions this week is, what's the first passion that you can remember that you had? And what did people do to either encourage that passion or to crush it? And it's a question you can think about for a while because God uses passion. He created us with passion. Every child is passionate. And what we think we have to do is to take that passion away from them. God says, no, let me take that passion. Let me work in it. You will never change the world if you don't care about something. Passion is just that you feel deeply about something. You will never influence other people by showing them how bored you are with life. You will never influence people by being just like everyone else. And it doesn't matter which field it is. The people who make the biggest difference in the business world are people who really believe in what they're doing and they're passionate about it. It's the same thing in the arts and in every other area of study, writers and people like that. There are these rare people who somehow life doesn't destroy their passion, and then they take what they're passionate about and they direct it in a way that changes the world. So it starts there with Saul. That's what I look at it and go, okay, yeah, he's breathing violence, and now he's like, you can't kill him. They stone him several times. Later on in this chapter, they're coming to kill him, and he goes in a basket and goes out the window and escapes. And it's like, you can't stop this guy. He's like the worst nightmare. He's like the new Jurassic Park, where it's like, whoa, what did we create here? It's like in movies all the time. It's like, okay, we create this machine, and the machine turns on us. All of a sudden, the artificial intelligence has intelligence. It's our worst nightmare because we just want everyone to settle down, calm down, let's just be nice, and let's survive life. God makes every one of us different, and every one of us has certain things and certain ways in which we could have passion. You can't teach people passion. That's one of the sad things about it. You can only help people discover their passion. The passion's in there. But discovering passion is something that at least now you don't want to be like everyone else. You are willing to be different. And that can become really inspiring. The second thing, though, that you see about Paul, with all of his passion, until he was blinded and humiliated in front of his guys, he was a prideful person. He was so arrogant, he was blinded by his narcissism because he knew he was right. He didn't care what anybody else thought. He didn't sit there and listen. He was unmoved as he watched Stephen praying for him to be forgiven by the same Jesus who confronted him on the road. But man, when you're the guy that's going around persecuting and killing Christians, and now you are blind, and the only people that can take care of you are Christians, how weird must that have been? That now he's like, I can't see, I'm not eating, I'm having these visions. And now the leader, one of the leaders of the church, that I was coming after him, I'm at his disposal. He could come in here and kill me, and he would be justified for doing it. That's humbling. And you know what? Discovering passion is really important. Nothing good will ever come in your life without passion. I mean, if somehow society has knocked the passion out of you, it's good to find it back. But the weakness of passion is that sometimes passion can make you proud because you realize, wow, I am so passionate, other people don't care like I do. And you begin to look down on everyone else because it's like, man, I have all this energy. I have all these feelings. I have done this. And other people are just like, you know, they're just bored with it all. Humility combined with passion becomes amazing. It becomes really powerful. And so one of the things that was blocking Saul was his pride. And so God had to slam something in front of him and say, how you doing now? What are you going to do with me now? You can't see. The people you hate are your only hope of survival. And all you know is you saw a vision, and I'm talking to you, telling you this stuff, and I'm telling you some guy named Ananias is going to show up, and you're like, I don't know. I am completely out of my element. Sometimes the best thing that can happen to you is for something to happen that you can't buy your way out of, that you can't argue your way out of, that you can't get somebody to cover your backside, and then you're like, uh-oh, I feel like it's a dead end. It's never a dead end. Hopefully it's the dead end of your pride. Hopefully you can get the arrogance knocked out of you, because if you continue to carry your pride and your narcissism, if you're not humiliated and humbled, as much as you hate it when that happens, then your passion isn't going to do you any good. It's just going to make you a weirdo. But man, you take a passionate person and you humble them, look out. I think, and I probably promote Apple computers too much, but Steve Jobs is somebody that I really admire. When he was You know, he and Steve Wozniak really started the first mass market personal computers, and it was amazing, and he was on the cover of all these magazines, and the company was just exploding, and then something came along, you know, called the IBM PC, and they did some things and marketed in ways that Apple wasn't, and Apple was arrogant. They didn't even feel like they had to do anything different than they were doing. It ends up the genius, Steve Jobs, who there, I know of no one who's any more passionate than he is, as was as a business person, he got humiliated. The guy that he put in power as the CEO of the company engineered his being removed. So now, very publicly, he is a pariah. He is the story of, man, the guy with all that potential and all that passion and all that arrogance, oh, he's being humbled. He went away, didn't know what he was going to do. He had a bunch of money. He bought a little company called Pixar that makes cartoons. Now, that's about as uncool as anything you could ever have at that period of time, because everyone knew only Disney makes cartoons. Pixar is a different company. There's two guys who are running Pixar who were smarter than Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs didn't know anything about Pixar. He owned Pixar, but he was humbled further when he realized what these guys could do with a bunch of little drawings put into, like, the first movie, Toy Story. It's like, what? This movie is outselling every other movie? But when Jobs was at Pixar, he understood, I don't know what I'm doing, but look at what's happening because of it. At the same time, he had a computer company called Next. That was his achievement. He knows computers. It ended up failing and selling out to Apple. But when Apple Computers was about to fold, they cried out to Jobs, and a more humble version of Steve Jobs came back, changed the world. The products that they're putting out, the way they're innovating and everything else, it's like with an arrogant, proud, the original version of Steve Jobs, that would have never happened. But him being humbled, it opened up new possibilities. He respected people much more. Now you can go, yeah, but it doesn't matter. Had he not been humiliated publicly, I don't think that company would even be in existence today. Just my personal opinion. I think the same is true for every one of us. I think we have to discover passion, and then we have to be humbled. We cannot be prideful because our passion is better than someone else's passion. We cannot look down on the dispassionate and go, well, I care about it. We do the same thing in the church. I mean, over periods of history, there are segments of the church where they're like super into it. You know, a little over 100 years ago with the Pentecostal revival, we saw this happen. All of a sudden, these people are like so passionate, rolling in the aisles, swinging from the chandeliers, waving banners, and they thought they were better than all these dead churches. And in some ways, they were probably right. Ultimately, though, as soon as you start looking down at people who aren't as passionate as you are, you kill yourself. It can't last. But when you take passion and you add to it humility, now there's something pretty powerful that's starting to happen. But there's another element that's so important, because there are a lot of people, like Steve Jobs, who benefited from being passionate and humbled, but there's something more to really change the world in a way that matters for God. And Saul, it comes down to that little thing that Jesus said to him, how come you're kicking against the goads? Why are you resisting what I'm doing in your life? A goad, as I said, if an oxen isn't moving, you poke it in the rear to get it to move. If an oxen is going off track, you poke it on one side or the other to get it back in line. What Jesus told Saul is, man, I'm into your passion. I get that. Now I've humbled you. But you know what? I have been trying to work in your life to steer you in a direction, and you would not be steered. You would not modify your course. You were so inflexible and arrogant that you believed that you knew what the end result is supposed to look like, and you're just going for that. He said, I've been goading you. And that makes me ask myself the question, where is Jesus goading me? Because if being used in a powerful way and changing the world in some way, changing other people's lives, making a difference, if that happens as you discover your passion and then you become humble about it, now it's just a question of, can you be steered? Can you be managed? And Jesus was trying to manage him. Paul probably watched Jesus preach, given the age that he was and where he was there in Jerusalem as a Jewish leader. He not only probably heard Jesus preach multiple times, he may have argued with Jesus himself. He no doubt watched him be crucified, perhaps even voted to do that. And then he sees what's happening, and it just made him madder. He watches Stephen is laying there dying at Paul's hands, and he's going, Father, don't lay this to that guy's charge. And still, he just got madder. Because sometimes that's what stubbornness and arrogance do. But now, Jesus is going, those things that you didn't like, that made you uncomfortable, I was doing that. And that makes me think, where is he goading me? Where is it that for my good and to make me more productive and helpful and meaningful and to use me to make a difference in people's lives, where is he poking me? And where am I kicking against where he's poking me? And one thing I've come up with that I've thought is, the first place to look is, what have you been praying for if you're a praying person? What is it that's in your life that you don't want it to be that way, and so you're asking God to take it away? Is it a sickness? Is it a boss that you don't like? Is it a spouse that you have a large life insurance policy on? Is it, you know, is it your financial challenges? Is it, what is it that you're just going, God, please take this away? I would suggest that probably your areas of greatest discomfort might just be the goading of the Lord. Because your life will never get better unless you are willing to change it. And if you respond to pain by going, okay, then I won't go that way, I'll go this way. If you live your life in such a way that you are steerable, that you are malleable, that you are flexible, now you've got something. Because it's just a matter of, will I go with whatever it is that's making me uncomfortable and seeing maybe that that's something that God's doing in my life? I'm convinced when we get to heaven, all the things, most all the things in our lives that we said, oh, it's the enemy, it's the enemy, it's the enemy, God's there with the goad going, what? It's not the enemy, it's you. You're listening to this. I'm the one who's doing this in your life. I did it for a reason. How many times have you seen God take something out of your life and you mourned it? And then you go, boy, I feel more free with that out of my life. So for each of us, we have to look at our lives and go, Jesus, where have you been goading me? Where have you been poking me? And where am I resisting your goading, your leading, your gentle touch? Because again, he doesn't put a wall in front of you and you hit a brick wall. That happens when it's like you're about to go off a cliff. Sometimes he goes, boom, and everything resets. But before that, for a long time, he's like poking. And he's making, just seeing if he can get you heading, if he can get you to move forward and then head in a positive direction. It's how he works, you know, with each of us. We have that opportunity. And so what we have here in Saul, or Paul, is a guy who found his passion. For him, his passion was theology and theological correctness. So he was into it. That's a good thing. But once he got humbled, and then Jesus was able to go, I'm just trying to change you a little bit. See, the Saul who was persecuting Christians and the Paul who was starting churches, they weren't all that different. It's the same guy. And a lot of times we think life means we need to do a 180-degree turn. Sometimes it looks like that, but usually that's really not what it is. It's usually he made you the way you are. You are unique. And he likes the fact that you're different. and you're special, even when you use your specialness as a bad thing. For Paul, it's like, I'm zealous for God. But as he described many of his Jewish friends, he said, I understand those guys. They are zealous for God, but not according to knowledge. They just don't know. So you take a Paul who was out of control, heading and trying to help God. And then you just go, okay, there. Boom, you send him off. He has the same passion. He has the same purpose. He has the same zeal. He has the same knowledge of the scriptures, the ability to reason, the fact that nothing will stop him. And now he's doing it for Jesus. And it really wasn't 180. It was a fine adjustment. It was when I worked in a machine shop, we had a sledgehammer that we called the fine adjusting tool. Because when you get a lathe set up a certain way and you're like, eh, it's like 10 thousandths off, just dink, okay, there. And that's kind of what he does in our lives, like dink, dink. It's not, you don't have to become a different person. You don't have to become not who you were. You can be who you are, and at the same time, he can use it. You know, I think of George Sabalik over here, one of the most amazing guitar players. And our whole worship team was just incredible today. We had a professional opera singer who's singing. I mean, that piano part that Steve did, the honk, kind of Jerry Lee Lewis honky-tonk kind of thing. And George just over there ripping. Well, you know, George spends hours and hours and hours playing guitar to be able to make it look like it's easy. At first, it inspires you to go, ooh, I want to start playing guitar again. Do it for like an hour, and he inspires you to just go, I'm never going to touch a guitar again. But, you know, a lot of that was learning Eagle songs and things like that. And then to have the chance to use it for the Lord, to have the chance, like at Christmas, to go out and play Christmas songs on his guitar, and, you know, and it's the excuse of the Salvation Army. He's raising money for a great cause, and he's just playing guitar, and people are dropping their jaws. It's not that much different being a rock star, being somebody who takes that same passion and gift and uses it in a little different way that makes a difference that people will remember forever. If you don't know what your passion is, figure it out. It doesn't matter what it is. Don't let somebody else tell you what you should be passionate about. Find your passion. At the same time, find your humility. And then say, okay, God, how do I adjust? How do I make a difference? What can I do that's uniquely for you? There's a guy in our church who, well, his wife is the opera singer who sang today, but he writes science fiction novels, just kind of what a lot of people would consider kind of junk literature. But he's really good at it and very well known. Well, this year, he's been asked to speak at the Comic-Con convention, and he loves Jesus. He loves apologetics. He wants to share the truth, and he's praying about, okay, what do I share at this time that's going to really influence people and make a difference? I love that. I love that he didn't just go, okay, I'm a Christian, so I guess I have to write novels about the rapture. No, he's like, he's still doing what he's doing, but there's this adjustment where he's using it as a light for Jesus. I love that. For many of us, we've never even got to the point where there's anything we feel that strongly about at all. Hey, if your passion is for your family, go with that. See what it is that you're good at, that you love, that you're passionate about. Commit it to him. Be humble in that. And then just go, okay, where are you poking me? Where are you prodding me? When I feel a poke, I'm not just going to ask everybody to pray that the poke goes away. I'm going to go, I wonder what's steering me in this. And you, like Paul, can change the world in some way. You can make a difference. Every one of us has influence on a certain number of people's lives. Starts with our family and our close friends. But there are other people who we are and how we live makes a difference to them. But the mathematics is awesome, man. It's like Amway, because you touch people's lives. Sorry if you're an Amway, or no, they don't call it that anymore, so I can say it. But then they touch people's lives, and they touch people's lives, and you're like, I'm actually putting a dent in the universe with whatever I do. So if it's like, here's what I'm doing, like Ginger over there playing a character at Disneyland, like touching the lives of these young kids that are just so excited to work at Disneyland, people who come and they see the joy on her face, it's like, wow, that can change the world. Because you just don't know how many people you can touch when they find somebody who loves what they do and who does it with humility and who is adjusting, who isn't just rigid, like, oh, I'm against that. I'm against people. It's so easy to be against things. It's so easy to be irate about things that you don't like. How about saying, where are the opportunities for me to make a difference in my world? And it can be with anything you do for a living, with wherever you live, with whatever your talents and gifts are. It can be the way you surf. It can be the way you love to talk to people. It can be the way you write, even if nobody ever reads what you write. It can be the way that you are a friend to people. It can be the way you visit people when they're in the hospital. Opportunities are endless. I know the times when I've been in the hospital, there are some people who walk in and they light the room up. You feel better just by them being there. Cherie Malin is one of those people who this week she's out in Vegas because she knows someone who's in the hospital back there. But there are other people who walk into the hospital room. It's like, this isn't your thing, is it? Because if Kenny Krikak comes into my room, I feel better. There are other people who will remain unnamed that if they walk in, their face says, you look awful. I just wanted to see you before you die, you know? But you find what you're passionate about, you are humble and you do it, and then you are willing to make adjustments. God can literally change the world through each of us. We have to get over that first hurdle, though, of what am I passionate about? Because he made all of us with passion. Somebody somewhere took the passion out of us. We've got to start there. That's where Jesus started, with the most passionate guy in the first century. He just happened to hate Christians. But that wasn't a problem, because at least he hated them really well. And then he goes, okay, let's just make an adjustment here, and you watch what I do. And he planted churches all across that area of Asia and the Middle East. He wrote 14 books of the New Testament. He changed the world. Where would you be? Take a look in your Bible and think, where would I read if I didn't have the book of Acts, which he didn't write? It was written by Luke, but it was written for him as a legal defense probably. But then the book of Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, Hebrews. What kind of a New Testament would we have without this spitfire? And he adjusted. They locked him up in jail. He wrote another book that would last forever. Amazing. What an inspiration. Now, if you're here today and you're just like, you know, I used to be passionate, but I can't really get into this whole religious thing, and I'm just too jaded now. I'm agnostic. I don't really, if there's a God, I don't think we can know him. I'm not really interested in becoming Christian, because I think when you become Christian, you automatically suppress all your passion. Well, I just want to tell you something. There is a God who believes in you. You talk about passion. Check out the passion of the Christ. The depth of emotion that it took for him to allow himself to be beaten and spit upon and humiliated and nailed to a cross. I mean, and our lives are revolved around, well, what did this person post? I like it. I don't like it. I'm going to change the world by posting something about this or that. Jesus posted himself for you. When you find somebody else who's that passionate for you, I'd love to hear about it, but he's always going to be there. And I'll tell you something else. You can resist him out of your pride, but he's going to keep poking you because he wants you. He wants to take your life and make a difference with it. Smart thing to do is, if he's kind of blinding you at this point and you're not sure what to do, surrender to him. Say, like Paul did, Lord, what do you want me to do? And he will tell you, just let me forgive you. Just let me give you a fresh start in your life. Just identify with me and ask me to be your God. You can do that today. Some of you might actually feel a prodding right now. Maybe this week was a hard week, and you're like, oh man, I'm coming to church, and I don't even know what they're talking about. maybe the person that prodded you to come to church was actually doing what God prodded them to do, because they knew, man, if you need anything, you need something that's worth being passionate about. You need to know that there is a God who loves you and cares for you. And so if that's you, your life can change forever today. There'll be people down here in the front who would just love to pray with you. If you want your life to start over, just come down here after the service. God might be prodding you as we stand up. If you're just feeling like somebody's pushing you forward, that's him. It's his little stick. He's trying to get you to go, please. Your life can still matter. I don't care how much of it you've wasted. I don't care if all of your passion left a long time ago. You can find your passion again, and I'll find it with you. And I'll end up steering your life, and you'll again discover a reason for living. So if that's you and you feel that prod, after we sing the last song, come on down to the front and start life over. For the rest of us, if this week we're looking at our lives and go, I don't even know where the passion went. I just don't get excited about anything. Get to him and say, I want to discover a real passion. A passion that I once had, that it's kind of been pushed out of me. It's been choked out of me. I want to explore ways in which I can exercise passion with humility. And then to say, when I feel poked, I'm going to assume that it's just a loving God trying to steer me in a direction that's going to make a bigger difference for my family, for my friends, for those around me, that I could impact the world, because that's what he wants to do. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for loving us enough to give us multiple opportunities. You created every one of us with a potential for passion, but through an obsession with utilitarianism, we remove our passion, we look away from it to do things that we don't really care about. Help us to rediscover passion in our lives. Maybe it's not our job. Maybe it's what we do after work. Maybe it's just allowing ourselves to be excited about our friends and our family and doing activities just because they're fun. Keep us humble. Help us never to look down our noses at people who disagree with us. Help us not to hate people because they don't see things the way we do. Please keep us humble. And then, Lord, help us, our first reaction, to not pray that a poking goes away, but to embrace that poking as possibly something that's making a fine adjustment in the path that you have us on. We really do want our lives to make a difference. And we know that they make more of a difference than we realize, but we want to move in the direction of changing the world. So help us to be inspired by people who have, people like Paul, who show us what can happen in a passionate, humble, flexible person. In Jesus' name, amen.